Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, welcome to the Curse on Film podcast. I'm Helen Seymour and I'm here with Jake. Hiya, Jake.
Hiya, Helen. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. We're looking at Captain Fantastic this week, Matt Ross's film starring Viggo Mortensen. It's a film about a family who have taken themselves away from society and are living in the woods. And then something happens, which means they have to go back and visit civilization. Really enjoyed this film a lot.
Is it fantastic?
It is. Yes, it is.
I'm sure that's not been done yet. So I think it's safe to say we've nailed that joke.
Absolutely, 100%. You completely nailed it.
Great, yeah. Yeah, it's a really fantastic film. Matt Ross, you may know from Silicon Valley, Mike Judge's HBO show that's just hit its third season. He plays the character of Gavin Belson, the CEO of tech company Hooli. And this is his second feature film, which he's written and directed, very much inspired from his own life and childhood and experiences as a parent.
Very nice. So in this film, there is a brilliant bit where instead of celebrating Christmas, they celebrate Noam Chomsky Day and they have cake and presents and they read things about Noam Chomsky. So we were wondering, if you had to do a day with a director, like celebrate a director's day, and you could spend that day with the director, who would it be and what would you do?
Okay, so I'm thinking if we're spreading out over the whole day, you've got to have a really good soundtrack over that day if you want to keep the energy going. But a great soundtrack needs peaks and troughs. Like you need, like for after lunch, you need it calm. You need that nice schlumpy feel. But then when it's getting around to party time in the evening, you need someone that can get out a killer party soundtrack. So I'm thinking Richard Linklater. Everybody wants some. Dazed and Confused. There's your party soundtracks. But then you've got like School of Rock in there as well. That man knows music. And I think present-wise, at the end of the day, Richard could give everyone a CD or a record that he thinks they'd like. But then we'd all just turn to him and like Boyhood, we could just go, I thought there'd be more.
Jake.
And then he'd just leave really sad.
And would that happen every year?
Every year, Richard Linklater would come to my house thinking he's going to have a really great celebration of him, and then he'd leave thinking that he's failed again. Yeah, again, every year he fails to deliver.
I was thinking Danny Boyle Day.
Right.
And me and Danny Boyle, just the two of us, would recreate his films. So it would change every year. We play all the characters. And then on the 10th anniversary, we do opening ceremony of the Olympics.
That's fantastic. And 127 hours, who plays James Franco? Who plays the boulder?
We do rock, paper, scissors to decide.
Okay.
Rock, paper, scissors. And every year I choose the rock because I think it's funny, but then I end up being the rock.
Yeah, and then you're just sitting on Danny Boyle's arm for at least 90 minutes.
Yeah, but it's still a good day.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of time to chat. It's very intimate.
It's very intimate.
Get to know you.
Yeah, Maybe we start with that. Maybe that's what we do, the first one. Okay. Present-wise, I didn't think of. Maybe we sacrifice a limb.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty good. You cut off each other's arm.
Yeah. That would work for 4 years.
Yep, cutting off limbs. And then... what else is there?
And then bag of cash.
Yeah, you could play the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire board game.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool, Danny, give me a call.
Yeah, and you could go running down the street like you and McGregor, and you could do it on opposite sides of the street and high five when you get to the middle.
Oh, you were really good at planning dates.
Me and Danny Paul. Danny, if you're hearing and you fancy a date, just give us a call.
Give me a call. Okay, so we're going to start off with the interview that sibling of the show, George Howlett, did for us with Matt Ross. Really great interview.
Yeah, yeah. George gets into a lot of stuff here. You know Sam, one of the regular hosts of this show. He did a radio show with his brother for quite a few years. And so George is stepping in to take his place as I fell off my skateboard, which sounds like a joke, but it genuinely happened.
He really did.
We're delighted to be joined here on the Curzon podcast today by our very special guest, Mr. Matt Ross. Matt, how are you doing?
I don't know if I deserve the mister, but thank you.
Well, we deserve a mister. So you're here promoting Captain Fantastic, your brand new film starring Viggo Mortensen.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we should start with the title.
Sure.
Sounds like a superhero film when you first hear it. Is it a jab or a nod to the saturated market?
If I'm guilty of anything, I think I'm guilty of underestimating the degree to which superhero movies dominate our cinema culture entirely. But the title is, I think the it is intentional. The reference to superheroic qualities is intentional. I think the title asks a question, which is he? And if so, how? And if not, why? And you could almost imagine a question mark after the title. And I think, again, the idea of parenting being a relatively heroic endeavor is something that I don't know if it's heroic, but it's certainly complex, and that it requires people to behave in a heroic manner sometimes. And so the title, you know, again, I'm not, it's not a jab towards Marvel or DC. I mean, I grew up reading comic books, and I love comic books, and I still go to the comic book store, and I still buy them on Wednesday. But I'm a little personally tired of having that be my only choice in the cinema. But again, it was really not a jab. It was just, I thought that there was something... It was intentional.
Yeah, intentional. Okay. Well, you mentioned parenting there, and this film asks a lot of questions about parenting. Mm. I was wondering how much of your experience of being a father is into the film, and specifically leads into the lead character, Ben.
Well, Ben is largely aspirational. I mean, I live in a town. I don't live in the middle of nowhere. I was raised in very rural areas and have lived in many times in my life in very rural areas. But in terms of parenting specifically, it's more aspirational than literal, though there are many things in the film that I do in my life that are also depicted in the film. You know, I mean, I've done martial arts my whole life, and I have my kids do that, and, you know, I try and bring my kids into the natural environment as often as possible. And though I grew up hunting and fishing, I haven't yet done that. But certainly my sense of humor and my politics and my view on the world permeates the film.
Okay. We talked about Viggo Mortensen's Ben there, who is fantastic in the film. Seems so perfect for the role. Mm. Did you write it with him in mind?
No, I think it's a bit of a fool's errand to write with a particular actor in mind, only because you have no idea who you're going to have access to, and then secondarily, you have no idea who's available. And a lot of our favorite actors, you and I can sit around, you know, batting names back and forth, and we can find out that they're not available for 4 years. So I didn't do that. I had probably a vague idea of Harrison Ford when he was in his early mid 40s. You know, movies around, you know, Witness and that time of his life.
Yeah.
There was something very powerful about him. I always thought he was both very masculine but also vulnerable. He seemed to be the very definition of a man, someone who was strong and capable and also could feel. And And then when it came time to cast it, Viggo was my first choice, but I hadn't, he hadn't been in my mind when I was writing it, no.
Okay. And in the film, he's joined by his six kids pretty much in most scenes. And
yes, almost all. Yes.
The chemistry between them is very important for the film to be viewed realistically.
Sure.
So how did you go about making sure they had that sibling?
Well, partially it starts in the casting, who you choose to cast, obviously. I mean, that cliche of directing is 90% casting is true, insofar as you're choosing the people with whom you're going to collaborate, and that's vital. You don't know, because like a job interview, people are always on their best behavior, and you have no idea what you're walking into. What I did to help the process was bring everyone there very early, and we did an extensive boot camp in Washington State. The children did a wilderness skills and survival camp where they learned to build shelters, learned to build fires, identify edible plants, learn basic tracking skills. They slept under the stars. The teenage girls butchered a sheep because in the film they dress a deer. And by dress, I mean cut up and chop into pieces. I don't really put a dress on. They were all doing musical. There's two musical sequences in the film, so they were doing music every day. They were doing rock climbing every day. George Mackay, who's British, actually, is from London. When George was cast, he was starting to do 3 or 4 hours of yoga every day because he does yoga in the film. They were all learning all these different languages, Esperanto. So that process is not so much about having them be experts in anything. They're also doing archery and fighting skills, all sorts of things. They can't hope to be experts, but what they can do is they begin to, you sort of acclimate them to the world of the film, but your real intention is to have them bond, to begin to know each other and trust each other, and so that the first day of filming it's not tentative, but they have a shorthand with each other. And also to look at Viggo as a father figure and as a mentor, and frankly to hopefully to fall in love with him and to trust him. That's really what it's about.
Okay. You mentioned George Mackay there, and you've also got Frank Langella. Well,
it turns out he pronounces his last name Mackay.
Mackay.
Yeah.
Oh, my first mistake.
Yeah, yeah. I think I knew George for 4 months before I learned that.
Okay.
He's overly polite and won't correct you.
Yeah. That's English for you.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, we've also got Frank Langella, Anne Dowd, Steve Zahn, and Catherine Hahn.
Yep.
So it's a big ensemble piece, almost. Mm-hmm. So how did you go about balancing every character but keeping the film focused?
I don't know how to answer that question. How do I keep it in balance? I mean, I think that, you know, the script is the document that you all agree on. You're all going to show up to do this thing, and each individual has their own reason for doing that. And then beyond that, you know, the balancing became... The first cut of the film was 3 hours and 30 minutes, which is far too long.
Yeah,
that makes a decent miniseries, but a very long film. And so there's an hour and a half of footage cut out. There are many scenes. Almost every actor lost entire scenes. Some lost most of their part. Missy Pyle, for instance, had another scene. She's a brilliant comedic and dramatic actress. And she, the very scene she probably agreed, the reason why she did the movie is not in the movie. And that you know, that had to do with, you know, you put it all together and you start realizing, well, I know this information, and though she's brilliant in the scene, it's not helping the movie be a better movie. And the real answer to your question had far more to do with the kids, because there's 6 kids in every scene, and I wanted to make sure, and I was very conscientious of trying to balance all of them carefully, so that every child had moments. And not every scene, in every scene, you don't need to see every kid, and they don't have to have a moment in every scene. But the collective whole, you hope that they are each given an equal weight. And that became an editorial challenge.
Yeah, because each kid has very specific personalities throughout the film.
Yeah,
that works really well.
Yeah.
So it's an independent film, obviously.
Yes.
And it's been notoriously difficult often to get these independent films made.
It's true.
I was wondering, in the process of financing, were there anything you had to cut back, any changes you had to make?
No, I mean, I can speak very frankly about this, that, you know, the equation, well, financing independent film, the viability of it depends on the equation presented. And in this case, you know, you have the script, you have the director, and you have the lead actor. I wrote the script, and I'm not a famous director, so that's already one tick against you. The script was, I think, largely, if not entirely, viewed very favorably. So we had choices in terms of who would finance the film. It became about who gave us the most favorable either numbers or people that we just thought wanted to make the same movie we wanted to make. And then Vigo was on board. He had signed on as we were putting the financing together. So then he becomes part of the equation. And every actor, when you're financing films independently, their perceived worth in the global market has a direct effect on how much money you can raise.
Yeah. Well, you did get it made, and it is excellent, by the way.
Thank you.
It's been shown all around the world in the US, France, Czech Republic, Israel. So I'm wondering why you think the film's got the universal appeal.
I think probably just because it's about family, and that, you know, I'm looking at you. There's a podcast. You're far too young to have children. although, you know, that's a socioeconomic judgment I'm making on you. You know, being in London, you know, I'm assuming at your age you don't have a kid, but you could biologically. I think that even though you're not a father, if you related to it, you may have related to it as a son, and maybe the George Mackay character was meaningful to you, or just you see yourself in your family and your father. And I think that. Many of our great dramas, whether we're talking about The Godfather or Henry V, deal with families, you know, yeah. And family dynamics. And it's something, well, frankly, so does Star Wars. I mean, what is Star Wars if not a father-son story on some level?
Yeah.
And I think that the specific becomes the universal because we all come from families. So,
yeah. Well, you mentioned the George Mackay character there. And you mentioned in the Q&A last night that he was mildly based on yourself.
Yeah.
You could elaborate on that?
Sure. I think that really he was based on me insofar as I had a very rural upbringing, and at some point when I was a little younger than George, I really yearned to leave the forest. I would live in a very isolated place, and I not only could I not play with kids my own age, I wanted to be around the opposite sex as I was coming to adolescence, and it was just an impossibility. And I remember feeling really trapped and crazed, and really only in retrospect did I realize that was such a strong current in the script.
Yeah. And in the film there is a new holiday which you created.
Yes.
Much like Seinfeld has Festivus, Noam Chomsky Day.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
So I celebrate Noam Chomsky Day in my own house.
Yeah.
On his birthday. And, you know, it started as sort of a laugh, I guess. You know, it was really that. It's not a laugh insofar as I think he's a great American who deserves to be celebrated as much as anyone, and I used it as a way to introduce a great thinker, a great American thinker, into my children's lives, and you know I bribe them with a piece of cake, and a present, but we celebrate. We celebrate the man's life by reading quotes and or bits, and as they get older, they're going to read Chomsky himself. And I just think he's a great intellect, and I think everyone should celebrate him.
Everyone should, and it's only 111 days, I can tell you.
Yes, it's coming. It's 111 shopping days before Noam Chomsky Day.
Yeah. So the film's done really well around the world. It's getting great buzz from all the festivals, and it's doing well in America. Mm. What do you think is the key attribute to its success?
I don't know. It's hard for me to answer that because I'm so in it.
Yeah.
I think perhaps, you know, one of the things that was intentional for me, or what I was hoping to achieve, and for the people who do enjoy the film, I think I've achieved this thing, which is that. The drug I'm always seeking when I go to the film, go to the cinema, is I want to have a film that makes me think. Not like it's homework. I don't mean like that it's a test that there's information I have to memorize. But I mean that actually forces me or helps me reflect on my own life, is relevant to me, and is an intellectual experience. And I'm engaged intellectually by the ideas and the questions. And I also have an emotional response. I either laugh or I cry, or hopefully both. And I want that. I want to be transported to somewhere else, you know, whether it's going to watch, you know, Alien and being in a film where I'm in space. But I want, the drug I'm always seeking is, you know, something that's both emotionally and intellectually enriching. And so I think perhaps for those that the film works, that's maybe why it's successful in any way. I think, I guess. I mean, it's hard for me to know. When I, you know, sometimes I've done some Q&As. Film festival is a little different, but when you have ticket buying audiences that are outside of the film festival circuit, and I've done Q&As at some places like that, the people that bother to come up to me afterwards, that's palpable. I can feel that, and that's something I can identify that seems to be working. So, yeah.
And these days, a lot of independent directors are being scattered out by the big studios for the films later on. Yeah. Would you consider doing a large franchise film?
Yeah, I mean, I think it absolutely depends on what it is. I mean, there was an article recently, and there's an American website blog called IndieWire, and there was an article about, you know, where do so-called auteur filmmakers go? And, you know, 20 years ago, you would start off and you'd make a $5 million film or a $2 million film or a $10 million film, and then the studios would eventually say, hey, you've done that well, we like that, how would you like to make the $50 million or $30 million or $20 million version of that? Well, that does not exist anymore. At all. So you have people, you know, we can name them, you know, people go from a small independent film and they're directing a Jurassic Park, or they're directing a Star Wars, or they're directing a Marvel film, and there are franchises that invite them. There are some franchises that I personally love and would be chuffed, as you say, to be involved with. But largely I think that those directors, you know, it depends on which franchise we're talking about, but a lot of them, the director's voice disappears and you really become a traffic cop and you're just sort of shepherding this franchise product out there. And that doesn't interest me so much. I mean, you know, maybe you get bigger toys, but I feel like at this point in my life, I'd rather make films that are broken and personal than that appeal to everyone and are empty. Because I find a lot of those franchise films to be largely empty experiences. Not all of them. I mean, I can tell you the ones I love, and there are many that I love.
Yeah.
But some I just feel like, okay, I've seen that movie 400 times, and that's a good version of that movie, but there's nothing that's moving to me, or it's not illuminating about the human condition in any way. Not that movies have to only be that, you know. The first Bourne films did that expertly well. The Paul Greengrass films were, I think, the best examples of franchise films that are also, they're basically $200 million art films in a way. I mean, they're really complex human stories that are also kinetic and huge in scope, and they're great films, you know.
Yeah, they are. Really good. I'll come to the last question now. Mm. And you're also known probably more so as an actor.
Sure.
And at the moment, you had a big hit with Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And your character, Gavin Belson, has a tendency to use animals in his presentations.
Yes.
So were you to present this film, what animal would you use?
Oh my God, what a great question. I need to call Mike Judge and Alec Berg, who are the originators of that concept. This film, I guess it would have been what I was demonstrating. I would be demonstrating that I want a film to be both intellectually stimulating and emotionally captivating. What animal would do that? Maybe the dolphin. I guess dolphin. Would I not have to present the dolphin? The dolphin is one of the most intelligent animals other than the human being, right?
Yeah.
So I would present the dolphin. And the dolphin would cry because we are polluting the oceans, as I want you to cry when you see the film. And they're very clever animals and empathetic. So yeah, maybe the dolphin.
Hard to bring a dolphin into a boardroom.
It would be hard, but not for Gavin Belson, because he would bring a huge tank filled with water that would be the size of this room. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, George. That was a really great interview.
Yeah, really fantastic interview from George and Matt on Fine Form there, talking about dolphins. So if you're wondering what all that last bit was about, do check out Silicon Valley and his character in that, Gavin Belson, who has a tendency to bring out animals to force a metaphor about the product he's launching as the CEO of this tech company. It's a fantastic show from Mike Judge, who directed Office Space.
Just something to pick up there as well from that interview, talking about how he doesn't write with anyone in mind. I thought that Viggo Mortensen was amazing in this, but can you think of anyone else?
Yeah, he totally encapsulates it as well, and you've got flavours of his character in The Road as well, perhaps without the world ending, but that stoic parenthood that just continues through adversity. And so that kind of makes me think of Robin Williams in like Good Will Hunting role, particularly Robin Williams could grow a beard. He could really grow a beard. And I think he would, if times were different and we had Robin Williams, I think he could definitely handle it. He could totally be Captain Fantastic.
I was actually reminded of Good Will Hunting at some points in this film as well. Not necessarily thinking of Robin Williams playing the role, but yeah, I can really, really see that. I also thought Fassbender would probably do a pretty good job, especially in the very intense moments, that kind of arrogance.
Yeah, I definitely the arrogance. Fassbender can definitely handle that, balancing that sympathy and arrogance in a very short space of time and shifting between the two. And that, because I think this film, you are constantly questioning the actions of the main character, and you need someone who's got a face and a performance that can be quite grisly at points but also very sympathetic.
Yeah, so he's taken his family and they live away from society and they live in the woods. And this is kind of one of those ideas that lots of people say is like the ultimate getting away from it all, the way to stop all your stresses and all your problems, the ideal paradise life. Mm. And what this film is really good at doing is showing the problems of that life.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
But not in a way that's saying, it doesn't tell you which life is best. It doesn't say, he shouldn't have done this, he should have done it this way, or we shouldn't do it this way, we should do it that way. It just raises an awful lot of questions, particularly looking at parenthood as well, and this idea that you're just doing your best when you're a parent, and it can be really, really difficult when you think you're doing the right thing for them and then it doesn't happen and it doesn't work out and you feel responsible. What did you kind of think about all that goes into it?
I think there's a lot of interesting clashes between ideas throughout the film. And when the family is forced to go outside and enter the city, you're worried it might turn into just this standard fish out of water comedy, and there's a lot of jokes like you could have, like, oh, the hippies don't understand the computers.
Yeah.
And you, like, that could have been laid on really thick, and it doesn't insult them like that because mm-hmm. they're clearly intelligent. All the kids are very intelligent, and so they would perhaps understand what these things are, but maybe not the use of them. And it could border on being quite pretentious and judgmental, and it just handles that very well. Not saying the people that love their computers and like video games are awful people, and the people that live in nature and live off the world are wonderful people.
Yeah, it doesn't do that at all. It really, really made me think just so much about how difficult life is, but in a way of just like everyone's just trying their best to figure it out, and you've got to have empathy to everybody's ideas because you can't dictate. There is no rule book for it.
Yeah, and I think this is something that when you're initially watching the film, you think, oh, you get completely swept up in this wonderful woods and the forest and the nature and all the things that you'd dream of doing. And then since watching the film and thinking about it and sleeping on it, it's almost a dictatorship as well.
That's a really good point to make. I didn't necessarily think that, so Viggo plays Ben, the father. I wasn't always on board with him. he has some great moments in the film. Like, if we're talking about first act stuff, you know, he has some great moments where I go, oh, that's a good point, fair enough. But there are also moments where I don't like him at all, because you're right, he's being a dictator.
Yeah, I mean, there is regimentation, there's forced exercise, there's communal song, and it's all done in this kind of twee round the campfire way. But on further analysis, you wonder how much choice there's actually been in there, and how much it's almost a Stockholm syndrome thing that they haven't seen anything else. So they enjoy this because it's the only way that there's been.
Yeah, totally. Are we going to talk a little bit? I kind of want to talk about why they move back to the civilization.
Mm.
Is that all right to talk about now?
I would say so. It occurs very early on in the film, the first 15 minutes. So Viggo Mortensen and the family's, his wife, their mother, suffers from bipolar. And after an incident, they're forced to come out of civilization.
Yeah. I thought that bipolar as well, using that as the reason why she's ill, was a really good... It was a very good choice of kind of plot and narrative, especially because the film kind of analyses what, you know, you want to be happy, but are you actually being destructive in that? And I think, as I understand it, sufferers from bipolar, when they are in a manic phase or when they are feeling really, really happy, they don't think there's anything wrong. Like, they won't want to go to the doctor because they don't feel that there is anything wrong with them. But this can cause quite a lot of anguish, because quite often they'll worry when they feel happy, am I happy just happy, or am I happy in a destructive way, as in, am I not actually well? And that can be really, really difficult for them. So I thought that was very good, and I think people that do have experience of that mental illness or know about it will pick up that, but it wasn't heavy-handed in there, but I thought that was very clever. And it also does a good job of, in these questioning of parenting, are you doing the right thing in terms of trying to care for someone who does have a serious mental illness. It's not heavy-handed, there's not really much dialogue around it.
Yeah, and it tries to open up the discussion of, you cannot blame in this situation. Like, there are characters that suggest that it's down to Viggo Mortensen, it's his fault that she's a sufferer from this.
Yeah.
And it tries to deal with the idea that you can't think like that.
Yeah.
Like, this is that, no matter how hard it is, no matter how close you are to that person, it is still their problem.
Mm.
Like, it's their cross to bear. You can help them with it. You can do as much as you can.
But that's it. It's doing as much as you can with the resources you have. Like, doing the best you can with what you have.
Mm.
And also kind of the idea that maybe it's not the way of life. Like, this is how horrible and, like, how unfair, you know, illness is. Maybe there wasn't anything in any universe that you could have done to have stopped being ill, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly it. They create this heavenly Eden paradise in the woods that would be the ultimate thing to make someone feel happy.
Yeah.
But it's not that easy. You can't just do something to make someone feel happy if they're suffering from mental illness.
Exactly. And, you know, that's not kind of the biggest bit of the film. This isn't a film that really looks at that, but it's all there. And I really respected that.
Definitely. And I think that's similar to the ideas of that treatment comes into the role of the parent in it as well, in that you try and construct the dreamlike raising of your child, and then it's confronting the reality of what it means to be a parent and the compromise that you have to make. Because I think living in this forest world is almost a way of Ben, the father, of dealing with what's happened and what's happened to his wife. And if he just continues with this, the way that they built it together, they don't have to change anything.
Yeah.
But when a spouse or whoever leaves, things are going to change, and you can't ignore that and just carry on like things were. You can, you have to make compromises, you have to change, and that's okay. and you, but it's, I think it's important to bring the children into the conversation and actually talk to them like people, which Ben as a character is fantastic for, and I think is something that a lot of people should be taking out of the film.
The way he talks to his children just as people and in a really respectful way. And there's a very good scene over a dinner table with some family of theirs, where they are talking about the mum and what's happened. And there's a contrast between the parents saying, trying to water down what's happened, and then Ben being very curt, but to the point about what's gone on, and not giving too much information unless they ask.
Mm.
And when they ask, he knows they're ready to hear it.
Yeah.
And that's phenomenal.
Yeah, there's a wonderful moment in the truck called Steve, which is a lovely detail. They have a big truck called Steve, and one of the youngest asks what rape is.
Yeah.
And then that spurs on to what sex is.
Yeah.
And that spurs on to what babies are made.
Yeah.
But he's asking the question, and he's taking it in, and he's asking follow-up questions. He's ready.
Exactly.
He understands.
Exactly.
Like there's a naivety to how much he understands.
Yeah.
But he still wants to know, and Ben treats that desire to know with respect.
He's such a respectful character.
Mm.
And, yeah.
But I think what comes throughout the film, he does have a tendency to get onto his high horse.
Oh, and particularly in later scenes. Yeah, I've just said he's very respectful, but he certainly does stuff that is not respectful to other people.
Yeah.
Because they are both sometimes fall into the territory of demeaning the other person about how they're living their lives. And because they don't agree with that, he's just going to storm on in and do what he thinks, and the same to the other family.
Yeah, there's a particular moment where, but throughout the film, Ben emphasises that actions are greater than words, and that his children would be defined by their actions. And then to emphasise his children's intelligence over his sister's children's intelligence, who are 5-6 years older than them, he asks his sister's children what the Bill of Rights is, and they said, oh, it's a receipt or something to do with the government. And then he gets his 8-year-old to come into the room and asks her what the Bill of Rights is, and she recites it word for word. And then he asks her, what it actually stands for. And then she goes into what the Bill of Rights actually means.
Yeah.
And that's all well and good, but he's just making the other children feel like idiots, and he's using words against them.
And he asked that question because he knew that his child knew what that meant.
Mm.
Like, he's being a dictator. He is controlling that entire situation. And it made me think, does it really matter who knows about... Like, okay, so your 8-year-old knows about the Bill of Rights. That doesn't make you a better parent.
Mm.
You can't play who's the better parent with games like this. And it's those moments that, yeah, he becomes really disrespectful, and he's not doing anything that's helpful or good.
Mm. And I think, yeah, he is very controlling. And the process through the film is more trying to understand that things are out of your control.
Yeah.
And people are out of your control, no matter how old they are. And no matter how hard you try, you need to let people do their own thing, which is ironically what he's trying to do at the start of the film.
Yeah. I feel like we're not talking about how colourful and beautiful and happy and how there's so many funny moments, because we've gone straight into the kind of the meat of it, but wow.
yeah it's very much an oh wow kind of film. Sadly the screening I was in the wrong aspect ratio, and so I didn't get these lovely widescreen landscapes.
No.
Which I know must have been amazing.
They
from
are.
What I saw. Yeah. And you've got this really lovely ethereal Sigur Rossi soundtrack that burns throughout the film,
and two really key music scenes that I know you talked a little bit about in the interview, which are amazing. And there's a beautiful use of light right at the end, which I don't want to talk about because it is going to spoil it, but it contrasts very well and kind of deals with grief very well, and it's so beautiful.
Mm.
Like, it's so oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's a very rich film, and you want to sink your teeth into every shot of it. There's so many lovely little details. The construction of the house in the woods. There's so many little bits that you see, oh, that's how that works, and that's how the tap works,
yeah.
And that's how that's a little treehouse where he keeps his knives, and there's one of the kids that is building his own shelter out of bones.
Yeah.
Like, all these wonderful things that you don't think... Because Matt Ross talks about there's an hour and a half cut from the film. You wonder what was in that. And,
totally.
But then I think one of the most important things about building character is you need to give people little bits of character. And even though you might see it as a passing shot, like building the house out of little bones in a treehouse, it's not essential. But it's leaving bits like that in that make you feel like, oh, these are kids.
Yeah. Also, towards the end, it's difficult to talk about without being too spoilery, but there's a very good shot that kind of made me think about how we celebrate is the wrong word, because I'm talking about when someone dies. How we remember, and the objects that we use to remember people, and how useful they are. There are so many moments like this that I'm not going to go into, because I'm just going to be saying words like I have that is some cryptic clue. But it's so rich in all of these little details. And at the beginning, it felt like I was in this kind of river with maybe eels in it. And I wasn't quite sure where it was going to go. And I didn't know who to trust. And I wasn't sure if he was a good person or a bad person. And then I kind of realised that, oh, yeah, no one's good or bad because I watched Harry Potter. And then slowly, the more colourful and the more beautiful and the more I grew into this family, it kind of, like, shrunk. And by the end, I was just in this, like, beautiful warm bath. And I honestly walked home, like, in this drunken state of happiness. Because I was just like, this film, like, it's made me think so much, but I feel like there was a solution to it. It wasn't one of those where there was an end and I was like, oh, what did that mean? It's complete, and I understand that family, and I understand that it's difficult, but it's okay.
And I think at that point, maybe we'll pause and listeners can go and actually watch this brilliant film, and then they can come back after they've seen the whole thing. And we can talk about elements from the final act, any revelations and details that you'd like to, get more information on or that we can talk about. But do go out and watch Captain Fantastic now. And we'll be talking about spoilers now.
She dies.
She dies. Although you talked about grief, so imagine people...
But who's grief?
she
kills herself.
That's again established in the first 15 minutes, but we tried to tread over that slightly. Although in the trailer, they do go to the funeral. So,
although, you know, maybe lots of listeners don't watch trailers because I know that quite a lot of people don't like to do that. So.
Yeah, from the cinema that I work in, the trailers are on all the time, except they're muted. So I get a very distorted idea of what films are about, particularly Wiener Dogs, because that definitely felt like some kind of like Valentine's Day, New York, New Year's Eve, Mother's Day kind of, oh, it's a crazy kooky dog and look at all these wonderful people. But it wasn't.
That's not what it's about.
No. So yes, the wife, or Viggo's wife, does kill herself at the start of this film, which then provokes a very blunt, perhaps too blunt, delivery to the children.
Yeah.
Very hard scene to watch, in fact.
Very difficult scene. And interesting that you were talking about things changing, because I think after he delivers the news, he says nothing will change.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And that is a bad idea, I think.
Yeah.
Just to tell people that the death of their mother doesn't mean anything.
Well, that's what he accidentally does.
Yeah.
I don't think he means to do that. He thinks he's doing the right thing by saying, okay, so everything was good then when we were here, so everything will be good now if we stay here. And towards... So there's a lot of debate about her funeral, and there's lots of people at her funeral, which kind of, again, indicates the life before they moved away. And how much of an impact she must have made on those people and had strong family bonds. And
yeah, I think so. Going back to you talking about mental illness earlier, it's brought up that the bipolar disorder came up very quickly after the birth of Bo Devon, the first child, and then that's when they started this idea of trying to get away, and they mentioned they went out to somewhere remote, and then they ran a farm, and then they went into this wood facility that they're in now. And it's almost like he took her away from people. If there are these people at this funeral that clearly she had a lot of connection with, and the family and friends that would have known her as a person, and then after this, after she gets bipolar, she becomes maybe down to herself and perhaps down to Ben, cut off from them.
Yeah. So she writes her will, which shows that she wants a very different funeral from the funeral that she ends up getting from her family. And Ben's character is very insistent on following the will as she's written it. And I think, again, this is a good thing that we, in talking about mental illness, because I think her family dismiss what she's written in her will because they say, I think some members of her family say, well, she had bipolar and you, Ben, made that worse, so we're not going to listen to what she's written in that will. And I think that's a big mistake that they make, because just because someone has a mental illness doesn't mean their ideas should be dismissed. And even if she was in a manic state when she wrote that will, then those were high... We'll never know if she was or not. So you can't just say, oh, she was, and I'm using air quotes, crazy when she wrote that, because that's what people are saying happened, but Ben's just following what he thought his wife wanted. And I think that's a really good discussion to open up. And what happens then is that they end up giving her the funeral that she wanted. And what I was trying to say earlier in my cryptic way is that they obviously go and get the coffin out of the ground, and then they cover it over again so no one's going to know that her body isn't under there. And there's just this shot of the grave after they've essentially robbed it. And it really made me think about the way that we celebrate that, because everyone's still going to visit her grave, but she's not actually there, and whether that matters.
Yeah, and I think actually covering the grave over is actually a very nice gesture by Ben, because ultimately when someone dies, anything that happens after it is for the living. It's not for the person.
Yeah.
And by recovering that grave, Ben gives her mum and dad and all the other people at the funeral the opportunity to continue their grief in the way that they would like to. And then he can take the body and celebrate her life in the way that her and her family would want to.
Yeah, and the way that he knew her. And those moments are really beautiful, and those are the moments with that gorgeous golden sunlight, and there's a very good music scene.
A kind of tribal version of Sweet Child of Mine.
Really standout moment. And the moment when they're in the van and they've opened the coffin and they're all around the body and they're brushing her hair or playing with her. And it's those things that it's that, oh, let's not talk about that because it's children and let's not do that. And then they're allowed to get into it because it's their mother and they should be, and that's right for them, and they're ready to do that. There's also a whole thing that we can't really get into because of time, because there's just so much in this film, but about whether the children are then going to live with the grandparents or carry on living with Ben. And there are some really, really beautiful moments with the children and Ben interacting. And Ben's character goes on a huge journey. If we see from the very, very beginning of the film, he's putting blood on his son's face from a deer that they've just killed and saying, the boy died today and you have become a man, going right up to the point where he's sitting with him and asking him, he's not telling him anymore when he became a boy or a man, they're actually having a conversation. And Bodevan has some really, really standout scenes as well, where he talks about how he knows everything in books, but he doesn't know anything about life. And there's all these moments that I need to stop talking because I'm rambling, but I love this film. Please go and see it.
Okay. Yeah, so I think we should maybe wrap up there. There's been some conflicting reviews for this film.
5 out of 5, no conflict.
5 out of 5 from Helen. And so, interestingly, Peter Bradshaw from The Guardian has given this film 1 star.
What?
Really took offence to it. Actually, I wanted to bring this up just because Matt Soller-Zeitz, who is the editor-in-chief for RogerEbert.com and a writer for lots of publications, who wrote the Wes Anderson collection, he's just releasing a new book called TV, The Book, which is an amazing title. He did a AMA on Reddit yesterday, and I asked him what he thinks about the reviews, positive or negative, that Roger Ebert, the great critic, wrote, that he conflicted with now as the editor-in-chief of his website. And he said, "I love Blue Velvet, which Roger had serious qualms about, but I don't tend to fixate on where I disagree with him or with other critics I admire. I learn a lot from reading other people's takes on things I like or hate. I feel that it sharpens my own arguments."
Which is exactly what I meant when I said no conflict.
Yes. So everyone, no conflict. This film is perfect. There's nothing wrong with it whatsoever. No,
that's a really good point. And I think, you know, reading it sums up what the film is about as well, about empathy and coming together from two different sides.
Yeah. So that's Captain Fantastic, which is in cinemas now.
Certainly is. I'd like to thank CSR for letting us use their wonderful studio. And, yep, check out Curzon Home Cinema for many good treats.
Yep, so they've just started a new curation strand. Every 2 weeks there's a new curated collection going out there based on a film that's perhaps in cinemas this week, or based on an actor, different things like that. So there's an Isabel Hubbard collection that's just gone live based on things to come that we reviewed last week, which is out on Curzon Home Cinema now, as are many other Isabel Hubbard films to go coincide with that release.
I wish everyone a wonderful week. Goodbye.
Bye.